That's Black Diamond, Sing Ebola, which is where we begin our news roundtable today. We are joined here by Dr. John Bullock, who is professor of political science at Towson University. Zoe Carpenter is a reporter for the nation's Washington, D.C. Bureau. Dr. Richard Vatz is professor of rhetoric and communication at Towson University's Department of Instructional Leadership and Professional Development, and wrote the book, The Only Authentic Book of Persuasion. And Dr. Diane Griffin is with us. She's a virologist and the Alfred and Jill Summer Professor and Chair in the Molecular Microbiology and Immunology at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Welcome all. Good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
You were taught by Alger Hiss.
410-319-8888 is the number here. You can write to us at talk@steinershow.org. You can log on to our Facebook pages. You can tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. But we're starting off with Ebola. Let me welcome Diane Griffin to the program. Thank you so much for taking the time with us this morning. And let me begin by just asking, there's so many things here that we've been looking at this horrendous crisis in Ebola in West Africa, and we'll talk about some of those other implications later in this half hour. But there's been a lot of argument over what we know and don't know about Ebola, about missionaries coming to being brought back to the United States and no longer having Ebola, and arguments about whether the treatment, the vaccine should be in West Africa or not, why it hasn't been used. Is this what cured the people? Let's A-beam with some facts, Diane Griffin.
Okay, well, first of all, we know a fair amount about the virus and how it's spread, and it has caused other outbreaks. This is by far and away the worst because they've had a very hard time controlling it, and they've had a very hard time controlling it because they've not been able to isolate people and to keep new people from getting infected, so isolate people that have been exposed or have the symptoms. Both the vaccines and the drugs that people have had in development for a long time, but sort of on a slow development path, none of them have been approved or for use in humans, and some of them we know work in monkeys, so we do have some evidence on efficacy. But none of them have been tested for safety in humans. This is true of both the vaccines and the drugs that have been worked on from an experimental point of view. So it becomes a very tricky question as to use of those drugs and which is mainly what people are talking about right now rather than vaccines.
Well, I guess I asked that question very specifically because I think it's important to clear up some of the mythology being thrown out here at the moment about ZMapp in particular.
Right.
That the two Americans that walked out of the hospital Ebola-free.
Right.
People say, it was because of ZMapp, and others say, well, no, it wasn't. We don't know why
it
was,
right? We have no idea whether that drug helped them or not. You know, a certain percentage of people survive this infection, probably about half, and it's probably a higher percentage if you have access to very high-quality medical care, supportive care during the acute phase of the disease. So we don't have any idea whether it was. It's a reasonable approach, and it has shown efficacy in animal models, but we have no idea whether it helped those people or not. And other people that got the drug, I mean, only three or four people have gotten it, but at least the Spanish priest that got it, he died. So,
Diane, Richard Vance here. I just wanted to ask for a clarification. I'm sorry, I wanted to ask for clarification on something she said. You say that 50% survived. Do you mean 50% survived without any medical intercession?
Well, it's hard to say without any. You don't know what percentage actually survive if they just stay at home and are never treated at all. But certainly there's an improved outcome for people who get medical care during the acute phase of the disease.
And I think there's something here about this is kind of very critical to talk about. I mean, I think that because the response of the world at the moment has been kind of pretty frightening, both the response within Guinea and Liberia, but some people in Guinea and Liberia thinking it's a hoax and taking people out of hospitals to the Europeans, quarantining people of African descent in Europe, shutting down whole buildings if someone faints who happens to be of African descent.
Yeah, the fear-mongering is bad.
Right. So, I mean, that gets in the way of the work. But, B, I mean, let's talk a bit about what that means and why that's occurring, do we think?
Right. Well, for me, this is John Bullock, and it reminds me a lot of what happened with HIV and AIDS years ago, right? So scientists can tell you that it's only transmitted through body fluids, which is the same way with Ebola, but then people are scared and thinking it's airborne or something like that. And there's also the perception, right? So you mentioned, black Africans who are perceived as a potential danger, even though there are also whites who also travel and live in Africa who come overseas and are not looked at in that same way. So there's this whole, fear-mongering, especially in the U.S. and the idea that, it's going to spread from one person to another, even though the science doesn't really follow that.
I think the analogy to HIV is a good one, because we certainly went through a period where that was a very fearsome disease and poorly understood. And I think that is certainly what's happening here. And in Africa per se, it's even more exaggerated because, of course, they see people go to the hospital and not necessarily come home. And so there's a lot of suspicion with respect, which existed well before Ebola, a suspicion of both Western medicine and of doctors in general. So that this kind of thing just exacerbates.
There's superstition, but there's also the feeling sometimes that medical knowledge is not certain. And why take a chance? I'm not saying that this justifies these wild kinds of theories, but some people believe that if you're not curing everybody, there must be areas in which medical science is unsure. If medical science is unsure, why assume that it's transmitted only by means that have been articulated? I'm not saying this makes sense, but I'm saying you can understand why, if the source isn't believed, doesn't have credibility, then people will make their own judgments.
That's true, and what can I say? I mean, we see that all the time with all kinds of things, everything from vaccination on up. So yeah.
Right, and I think probably the danger there, though, is when you see heads of government, when governments themselves, when official institutions are the ones who are posturing this and pushing this as policy, that's where the danger, because that erupts into a larger fear among people in the population.
Exactly.
And fueled by other things as well, which I think is part of the danger. Do we, and Zoe, did you want to jump in here with a thought or question as well?
Well, I just, in terms of sort of the racism and fear-mongering that's happening, I think it's interesting that we've seen some conservative politicians jump on the train there and use it to talk about border security in the U.S., and I think that's another example beyond HIV about the ways in which the Ebola crisis is being used really opportunistically to back up a completely different political argument about closing the border and things like that. So I think that's sort of the national political context into which Ebola is being put into here. Hmm.
That's a critical piece of this too, I think. And I think that we always use these things to kind of extend notions of security.
Right,
and I wonder when it comes to actually the work around Ebola itself, Diane Grayfield, as long as we have you here, mm-hmm. What do we really know of its origins?
Oh, well, it's most likely, and there's pretty good evidence, it's not rock solid, that the reservoir for this virus are bats, and that the initial person that gets infected is in any of these outbreaks has been exposed to bats, either has worked in bat caves or, in almost always in rural areas is where the very initial case is. But then once it gets into the human population, it's this nosocomial spread, which is spread from person to person by direct contact with people. So, and it also has caused outbreaks, similar types of outbreaks in gorilla populations. So primates in general are very susceptible to the virus. The bats don't seem to get sick. And so they're a reservoir, and it's this intermittent sort of random or unpredictable acquisition of the virus from the bat population that then introduces it into the human population, and then it becomes the critical step to control that, quarantine those people that are sick, and keep it from spreading further. And West Africa's had a particular problem because it's got out of rural communities into very highly populated urban communities, which has made it much harder to control.
And there's also been, some of the articles that we've been reading talk about people consuming bushmeat
right,
as it's called. Is that still a basis of where Ebola is coming from?
Well, no, because, it could be. It isn't that it's impossible, because they may be more likely to catch a primate or shoot one or capture one for meat that has that's sick. And as I say, primates get sick with this virus just like humans do. So it's possible you could acquire it that way.
So now, what do we know about its cure and treatment? I mean, where are we with that research?
We know very little. As I say, the drugs, we know very little about the pathogenesis part, you know, and how the virus actually causes such severe disease. And that's partly because it's been hard to study people with the virus in the kinds of settings where these outbreaks have occurred. It may be one advantage of the people that came to Emory. I can imagine that the virologists there are working very hard to understand how those people responded and what their immune responses were to the virus, what kinds of problems the virus actually caused, being able to study in a more sophisticated setting. So we may learn a fair amount from those people.
Dr. Ian Griffin, I deeply appreciate you taking the time with us here on the Mark Steiner Show this morning. It's been really, we've learned a great deal just in the 20 minutes we've had with you. So thank you so much for being part of this program.
You're welcome.
Take care. Bye-bye. Dr. Diane Griffin is virologist and the Alfred and Jill Sommer Professor and Chair in Molecular Microbiology and Immunology at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Health. And let me just ask you all to pick up from this. I mean, just the politics of this we were talking about earlier. Right. You mentioned one, and so you mentioned this kind of the U.S. even dealing with border issues. How is that playing itself out? Zoe.
You know, I think that it's kind of going into an echo chamber. I don't think anybody's really, I don't think those claims about Ebola coming over the border are going to get much credence, except maybe in right-wing media. You know, that's the favorite talking point of anyone who is a nativist or opposed to immigration in general, is that somehow a border that isn't completely sealed shut will let all sorts of unimaginable threats through, from Ebola to fighters from ISIS. But I think that just really points to how obsessed the American right wing is with the border and the strains of xenophobia that lie within that party.
Do you know of any serious conservative sources that have argued that Ebola is a danger in illegal immigration?
That's Richard Vetz, by the way.
Yes. So I can pull up some names for you right now, but there are several conservatives in the House who have made claims. One of them wrote a letter to the CDC requesting more information about how that might happen.
Yeah, but this does not represent serious conservatism. I mean, I really think that you're using too broad an argument when you say that right wing sources. You know, I mean, I don't know any conservatives that make this argument. I'm sure there are some. Yeah, you know, I'm sure anytime you go through the Senate and the House, there are some crazies.
Well, let me just read you off a list of people. Congressman Phil Gingrey, is that his name? The Georgia Republican was one who wrote the letter to the CDC and is worried about people carrying such deadly diseases as swine flu, dengue fever, Ebola virus, and tuberculosis coming into our country. The storm was kind of breathed with a little life from your friends Sean Hannity and the rest at Fox News and O'Reilly and who were kind of pushing this idea on the air. So yeah, I mean, it has gotten, you know, that which is a network that is kind of known for. We were talking about this morning. It's like pushing the untruths of the world. The first ones to put out there that Officer Wilson had his eye socket broken, right, was pushed all day long on Fox, found out to be a total fabrication.
Right, right. So let's talk about this word reality. And people may argue about using the labels right or conservative or Republican, but the point is that we do see it more from one side than the other. And again, you can align Fox News with that. But here's what it all comes down to. The lack of knowledge leads to fear. So if we don't know how it's cured, how it's transmitted, even though we do know how it's transmitted, that leads to that fear. And so you have that social stigma in those countries where either leaders and residents themselves, citizens themselves, don't want to get treated because they know there's social stigma attached with it. Then that social stigma also goes over borders, right? And so now in the U.S. we're starting to see this reaction. And again, xenophobia, which the term was mentioned before, is fear of the other, right? And so what are the fears of immigrants? And it's very easy to put it on either, you know, people who are citizens, people who are residents, Black Africans, Hispanic Americans, or or immigrants or whatever who may look differently, phenotypically different, and it makes them easier targets to be seen as those who may be suspect and possibly bring something over our borders. And so I admit it may be a more limited case, but the problem is when you have fear and fear-mongering, that this thing can grow, and if there isn't any way, if there aren't sensible heads or sensible voices who are able to put a stop to this, then it winds up growing. So right now it is somewhat limited, but it is worth keeping a note and keeping an eye on.
So, and I think that there's the kind of the politics of Ebola is I guess something that can be wrestled with here, both in terms of how other countries are responding to it. There are countries throughout Africa that are nations throughout the continent of Africa, Senegal, South Africa, who are blocking plane flights, flights from Guinea and Liberia to their countries, and the Europeans kind of going off half-cocked on communities of color across Europe around this issue. So those things are there as well. And I think that, you know, I wanted to raise the issue with Diane Griffin earlier because there was a lot of paranoia saying that why, if we knew the ZMapp is working, why aren't we giving it to African the folks in the continent to stem the spread of Ebola? But it's very clear that we don't know if ZMapp works. And I'm sure that in some cases, if ZMapp had been used in Guinea, Liberia, people were saying, why are you using this as guinea pigs? I'm saying so it's...
Right. You can make the argument either way, but it's all post hoc ergo propter hoc. Nobody knows. You know, and so at this point, people are just acting on superstition.
So folks, join us here, 410-319-8888, as we explore this and other issues. 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. You can also email us. You can also tweet me at Mark Steiner. Jump onto our Facebook pages, 410-319-8888. Let me move to kind of a piece that's been all over the news, and just to get our listeners to think about this. President Barack Obama has been kind of under a major attack. Major attack, A, from some people on the progressive end of the spectrum because he's not acting strong enough when it comes to Ferguson, Missouri. And he's not there. He's not being openly empathetic. He's not coming and sitting with the family as he did in Newtown, Connecticut. And then he is being attacked from the right because he's not going in there and bombing and sending troops to Syria. So, I mean, this is – I'm curious what we all think.
Everybody's right.
Poor President Obama says wrong. But so, Zoe?
And that's the point.
No, I mean, that's what happens to the president. He gets criticized for all of – for anything that he does. You know, I don't think that we can learn that much necessarily from those criticisms. You know, we're always going, people like John McCain are always going to be rattling the sabers for war anywhere, the Middle East or North Africa, right?
Lord.
And
I think John McCain is very, very responsible. Okay, go ahead.
You know, meanwhile, regarding the Ferguson and the criticism about his approach to Ferguson, you know, I think there were high expectations that he would embrace a role not only as the president, but as the first African-American president of the U.S., and the fact that he doesn't speak out particularly explicitly all the time about race, I think, does anger a lot of people. I think it's interesting to look at the difference between the way he's spoken about Ferguson and the way that Attorney General Eric Holder has, and Eric Holder has been much more direct about some of the issues of race that are raised in Ferguson. And the president, meanwhile, has said that he doesn't want to put his hand on the scales while the investigation into the shooting is ongoing. And so I think that we see the reluctance of the commander-in-chief to get involved in issues where it's a legal question as well as sort of a ethical and moral and historical question about racism in America.
We're going to take a very short break and come back, and we're going to let both of you come back and tackle that. And I think some of the questions I have of what the president's office could have done short of what of going to Ferguson. But we will raise those issues and talk about ISIS and take your home calls at 410-319-8888. Stay with us. We'll be right back. We went out with the OJs during that break and came back with the OJs because Walter Williams of the OJs was born on this day in 1941. Any excuse to play the OJs, as far as I'm concerned. There we are. So, what were you going to say, John Bullock?
Look, we started here, you know, for the love of money, and you were talking about the president's response to Ferguson, but look at the response of people around the country who have contributed funds to Darren Wilson. And so it really puts the president in a really interesting perspective. I mean, they've raised over $200,000 for the gentleman. And again, we can, you know, we clearly know, you know, at least what happened, the unarmed, you know, person was killed. But the president, again, has weighed in before vocally on issues, and he's gotten a lot of pushback for it. So what he's done is really what the, you know, the Office of President, you know, can do in some ways. Eric Holder has been very, very outspoken about it. He's talked about his own experiences. But the real important part for the Office of the President is to marshal federal resources. We know historically in America that when localities, or states and localities, are going to trample over the rights, particularly of minorities, that's the federal government that can come in and play that role. So whether that's the federal government assisting with the investigation, doing additional autopsies, you know, pushing the envelope in terms of civil rights violations, I think that's very, very important. But again, the president has been so sort of dispassionate, and it has to do with, again, always being wrong. If he speaks too much to it, he's going to be wrong. And again, there's a larger swath of America that, again, would feel some kind of way about the way that he spoke about Trayvon Martin, the way he's interjected himself in other issues of race in the past.
Let me say a couple things. First of all, there was a particularly irresponsible editorial in the Washington Post by Michael Eric Dyson of Georgetown, who also works for MSNBC, in which he criticizes the president but doesn't say exactly what the president should have said regarding the particulars of Ferguson. The fact is that in the issue of Ferguson, the word "and" has to be used more. Everybody selects facts and ignores other facts. Not that the police were out of control, Michael Brown was killed, but there was kind of a police riot, Michael Brown was shot, and there was looting, and Michael Brown robbed the store and committed a battery. So I'm just struck by the fact that everybody seems to have their own set of facts that they use and ignore other facts when they're discussing Ferguson.
Well, I do want to push back on something. I think it's important, again, to talk about those facts. But again, the fact is, even from the store owners, that he did not rob the store. They actually did purchase cigars. Now, the amount that he purchased was in question. And again, that the store owner said that they didn't call the police, right, and that the police came in and demanded those tapes. And so if you look at it and say, well, interestingly enough, we ask about, what happened that night, and we'll tell you, and we will release some footage that is not really confirmed about what happened, but we won't tell you the appropriate information. And again, we could say, yes, there was looting that happened, but the main issue that we're talking about is an unarmed African-American teen being killed, and that this is not an isolated incident, particularly as it relates nationwide, but also in St. Louis and around St. Louis and some of those surrounding suburbs and counties, that this has been a habitual issue, and that why we see the outrage that we're seeing from the residents on the ground there.
Zoe, before we go to the phone, do you have a thought on this as well?
Well, certainly I think that the selection of facts by the authorities is the most troubling thing, and we always expect the left and the right to select their own facts, but the people who are supposed to be impartial and the arbiters of justice in this case have really been egregious in highlighting certain things. For example, the video of the convenience store alleged robbery, and not other information that the families requested.
And if you look, and this is going to go phones here, but if you look at, I think, President Obama's response to many things, I was having this conversation the other day. In the very beginning of his administration, he kind of saw himself as Lincoln-esque. Mm-hmm. In many ways, he is. Because if you look at Lincoln's tenure as president, before the Emancipation Proclamation, before he was pushed into bringing African-American troops into the war and changing the nature of the war and the nature of the country that way, he was always doing the same thing. He was saying, I don't want to take a position because this side thinks this side thinks that. Let me see if I can figure out a way to bring them together, which we had all these political cartoons about Lincoln being wishy-washy. And there was one cartoon of dogs chasing him as a raccoon up in a tree. You know, he was. Mm-hmm. It was from both sides being attacked. And so it's interesting to watch these comparisons mm-hmm. historically. And I think that what you're seeing, though, is people in his administration who, like the Attorney General, who are kind of making the statements. And when he said that I can see this both as the chief law enforcement officer of the nation, and I see this as a black man. He's mm-hmm. you know, and so, and in some ways, that's speaking to it from a different end.
Right.
And I think that would not be allowed otherwise. This is why you're watching with the Islamic State. You're seeing both Secretary of Defense the Attorney General, and others speak, and the Secretary of State talking about IS as a world threat. Well, he has not yet gone there. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So I think that the administrations always do this. That's how the game is played in Washington often.
Right. You have to speak through surrogates. I mean, that's why you have a cabinet. That's why you have these people, right, who I may not want to say it, but I can put you out there to say it and take the heat and you know, and be that person that's responsible for it. Again, even what Eric Holder said, I mean, Barack Obama said similar things about Trayvon Martin could have been his son. I mean, clearly, you know, all things that Eric Holder said he experienced are things that most African-American men have experienced. But again, he can't come out and say those things with that final point.
Let me go with the phones here first. 410-319-8888. Let's first go to Lee in Washington, D.C. You're on the air.
Thank you, and good morning, everyone.
Good morning, Lee.
I had a question going back to the Ebola piece that initially started the program.
Sure.
And wanting to know, why hasn't a question been raised about the protocol that were used for the two medical care workers that returned, as opposed to focusing solely on the VMAP serum? Like, what actual protocol was used, since they did so well, if no one can pinpoint to say that VMAP was actually a possible cure for these workers? But what was the actual protocol? Why isn't that being shared?
Well, I think it was shared. I mean, I think that this report I heard, a pretty extensive report I heard on National Public Radio, and read one in the in a British journal, was that he did a massive transfusion from a young man who was 14 years old who was treated for Ebola, and I believe it was Liberia, and that was part of his treatment. This attacks your electrolytes and other functions like that, and they gave him massive doses of drugs to attack those issues in his bloodstream and in his body, and he was also given the ZMAP. They are not sure what worked. They're not sure which of these protocols actually were effective and what were not, and whether they were going to mend on their own anyway. That's how little they know. So that's why when you see people who contract Ebola, that they are isolated because of the dangers of others getting it because of interaction with bodily fluids and sweat and tears and whatever else might be. So they're isolated, and that's why people treat them in isolation units.
Medical science experimentation requires time.
Because they don't know. We don't know.
Exactly.
Nobody knows.
Exactly.
And I think they're desperately trying to figure out what it is. And I think this is also part of – there are all kinds of theories about why it exists.
Right. And it requires time, as you said, but also resources. And the fact of all the things you just mentioned, you know, that requires a whole lot of resources. And clearly those things are not able to be distributed across the world in every different pocket. So you have places and centers in the United States and some in Europe that are able to do it. But again, the resources and the time's not there.
That's why in certain places right now, when you read what some of the medical workers and the governments of Liberia and Guinea are trying to do, which is why they're trying to get people out of those ramshackle hospitals, mm-hmm, in the rural areas and put them into spaces in the capital cities where they can actually be treated the way we know. And I think that's part of the problem. People, because of the years, I think, of colonialization and the relationship that Africa and African people have had with the West, that there's a lot of fear and paranoia that this is just another way of killing Africans. Mm-hmm. And so they don't trust what the West is saying or doing. I think that's part of this, too. It's a very complex kind of thing we're addressing here.
I wonder if I could get back to the Michael Brown situation for 1 second.
You can, but let me go to the phones, and then the next call is about that, and we will do that. 410-319-8888. Join us, give your thoughts on whatever subjects we're raising today. Love to hear your ideas. And Clarence, you're on the air.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Steiner. Good morning.
Good morning, Clarence.
Your guest said that mentioning the response to the federal government in reference to violations of civil rights. Well, that's just the problem, because when there is an incident of a police shooting of an unarmed person, it should be clearly defined by the federal government what is. If you're not in imminent danger, if that officer is not in imminent danger and a person is shot, then the Fed should immediately be called in to arrest and take control of that. That should come from the federal government. And as response to Barack Obama's response, you cannot hold the president responsible to every occurrence in a physical space of this sort. I mean, it's ridiculous to even suggest that, you know. So thank you for that, Mr. Steiner.
Thank you so much. And Richard, you had a thought.
Yeah, there is a consistent conflation of a multitude of cases with respect to the Michael Brown situation. Most prominent to me is the conflation of the Trayvon Martin and Michael Brown cases, which I think are completely at this point dissimilar. I'm just speaking as one observer. In my opinion alone, I think that Trayvon Martin was murdered by George Zimmerman, who then was acquitted. Michael Brown, you do not have that information yet. You cannot make a disposition on that case. I don't think I understand that the relatives of Trayvon Martin are linking up with Michael Brown, but right. In my opinion, there is a tremendous difference evidentiarily between the Trayvon Martin cases and what we know now about the Michael Brown case.
And I think that let me go to Zoe and John here on this and throw a comment in between that is precisely what Michael Eric Dyson, I think, was addressing in his Washington Post column, which I also read. What Michael was trying to say there is that what Obama didn't touch on is that the link is that what happens to young black men in this society at the hands of authority across the board is the link. And it's not a question, as he wrote, as he said, the president said, that blacks feel left behind or are subject to different rather than fury brands of justice. Mm-hmm. I mean, and the facts are there in terms of who goes to jail, who's killed by the police, who's mm-hmm. beaten by the police in this country. Those are the things, I think, that are the common thread that America, some people in America, are looking for a conversation, a way to address that particular issue. Zoe, and I'll come back to you. Zoe?
I think the other connecting thread is what happens after the death of these unarmed young black men, in the sense that, yes, it's true, we need to know all the facts and that justice needs to play itself out, but there was an immediate sense that a cover-up was being undertaken by the authorities, and I think it's all well and good to say, well, we can't judge this case yet, we don't know the facts, but why then would the authorities start putting these stories out in an apparent attempt to smear Michael Brown? And that seemed very similar to Trayvon Martin in the sense of, raising concerns about whether he was on drugs and trying to make him into a criminal.
Right. I mean, we can concede that, we have one who shot by a self-appointed neighborhood watch person. We have someone who shot by the police. But again, the consistent theme, two young African-American men, unarmed by all accounts. And then after the fact, like you mentioned, there's the character assassination to say, well, both of them have marijuana in the system, as if that is somehow, makes them super lethal, super thug criminals who now require multiple shots to be taken down. Again, the idea that someone could be shot six times while they're unarmed, twice in the head and several times in the arms, that somehow that could be justifiable. And then the response, if you look at it, very similar. You look at the money that was contributed to Trayvon Martin, who by all accounts we see shot an unarmed person, murdered an unarmed person, got off with it. And then we see, the money for Darren Wilson. Why? Because the assumption then is that you must have been in some imminent danger. And I think this idea of, particularly of young black men and even young black women, we know many cases around the country, that's the consistent theme that many people are seeing. So even though some of the background might be different, the outcome still reminds of being a dead young black man. And again, this character assassination that occurs as well.
Well, this reminds me of the tremendous array of coincidences that people argue existed in the John F. Kennedy assassination and the Abraham Lincoln assassination. And the fact is that you can always find facts that indicate that there are commonalities. But George Zimmerman stalked Trayvon Martin and killed him. And then, the only witness being dead, they were able to manufacture evidence or manufacture a lack of evidence that argued that he was standing his ground. The Michael Brown situation is completely without evidentiary finality. And he was not stalked by a community organizer. I'm just using that term.
He was not a community organizer. He was a rent-a-cop.
Right.
He was a security officer.
I think George Zimmerman should have been convicted. I think it was clearly a case of murder. And the jury didn't. And that's a valid argument to be angry about that. But Michael Brown, I want to wait.
But, I do think that we're sort of losing the point when we start getting into Trayvon. Because if we look at Eric Garner in New York, we can look at, all the people, Sean Bell, people who have been killed by the police. And that's the larger issue that the death of young black men, not usually it is by the police. And that oftentimes the police are actually acquitted or supported by the color that is blue, not necessarily racial.
Zoe?
And I think that's going to be really difficult in the prosecution here. The problems of confronting police violence in the courtroom are serious. And if we look at what we can hope the federal investigation to accomplish, that's a civil rights investigation, and those are even sometimes harder to adjudicate. So I don't know that we'll see what'll come out of the courtroom might be diminished in this case.
And I think that this past weekend, Eric Garner was buried. I mean, they had a march in his memory in New York, I should say. And Tyrone West's family from Baltimore went and marched with Eric Garner's family. And I had been tweeting and messaging with Tyrone West's family, and we're going to look forward to having both they and the Garner family on this program later in the week. But that what you were saying, Rick, I think is important. That's what the nation has to wrestle with, which is that we don't – I think many in America don't see the connection between all these murders as having to do with both the racist past in America and the racist present in America and how they're connected. And why people like this why people are victims, why so many Mexican-American and Native American and young black American men especially are victims of this kind of sanctioned violence by established authority in America. That's the connective tissue. It's not whether they've proven what the Officer Wilson did or didn't do. That is irrelevant to to the larger discussion of what some people were hoping maybe President Obama would have said that we have to address in this country, as he tried so eloquently earlier to talk about in those years back in his speech about race. So that's the core of the issue.
The more you extrapolate, the more you make it some more general issue, the more commonalities you can find. But when you have cases that have been compared to the Michael Brown case, such as Emmett Till, okay, an absolutely outrageous, despicable example in American history. I think it takes away from the poignancy of Emmett Till, which was just outrageous and unstomachable. And I don't think that all of these things are the same because you find some element in these cases wherein there are racist people acting. There are elements. You are correct on that. That does not
The difference is whether it's element or whether it's a pervasive reality in America that is allowing these things to happen. That's a huge difference.
I think that's the key.
And there is a phrase of reality. I mean, let's be frank about it. You know, one of the things you alluded to was the racist past in America. And we know that many police forces in both the North and the South were also staffed by members of the Ku Klux Klan or other white supremacist organizations who did use that role to use vigilante violence toward blacks and whites. If you look at Goodwin, Cheney, and Schwerner in Mississippi, again, we're talking about people under police custody who were then released in the middle of the night who were then murdered. So there's a whole history of this. And actually, if you look at some of the accounts that have been coming out of Missouri, you find out that Officer Wilson and others were part of another task force, I believe, in Jennings, Missouri, where they was actually disbanded because of a whole history of racialized violence, again, toward black citizens. Again, looking at police forces that are staffed by people who do not live in those communities, who then police those communities and use those and attack the people as if they are in a war zone. So whether we're talking about stop and frisk policies that then target young black and Hispanic males, we look at the common denominator that throughout history, we can look at, you know, unarmed black men. Look at Amadou Diallo, Abner Louima. Look at all these people who have been assaulted or murdered by the police.
So let me let Zoe come with a comment, then I'll go to the phones and come back to you, Rick. Zoe?
Sure. I just wanted to go back to the comment about Emmett Till and how that was unstomachable. I mean, I think I don't know how we decide which death is stomachable and which one isn't, right? I mean, and I think that's the importance of drawing these broader lines is to say the whole situation, the pervasive injustice, pervasive racism is itself unstomachable. And yes, each case and each death deserves to be honored in its specificity, but you know, the whole situation, the economic disparity, that all should be unstomachable, not just one person's death versus another's.
Send me to the phones here, Rick, and you come right back, okay?
Okay.
410-319-8888. Oh, we have a few more. Why don't you make a quick comment back, then I'll go right to the phones.
I guess I was going to ask John, does he have evidence that Darren Wilson specifically was culpable in that situation that you mentioned?
When you shoot somebody six times and twice in the head, somebody's unarmed, you're culpable.
No.
There's no argument about that.
The early situation where the group was disbanded.
Oh, no. What that speaks to is a general culture of racialized violence.
Yeah, but that's playing a little fast and loose with that particular fact.
Well, if you connect the point A to point B, that, again, this has happened in a consistent manner within that police department, that there have been a number of civil rights complaints.
Ergo, Darren Wilson was guilty.
Well, who's dead and who's alive? And who's got, let's be frank about it.
I'm sorry. That's
real.
I guess, again, I'm trying to push the theme again and go to the phones here, that for me, it, it goes beyond any of the what are the facts in the case. I really don't care at this moment with the facts in the case. The larger fact in the case of America is that over 400 black men, not counting Latino men, but Mexican men and Puerto Rican men and Native American men in this country, are killed by authority every year. That's the question.
Right. And then they're
That's the question.
They're always guilty until proven innocent. And then we look on the other side and say, well, what are the confounding reasons of why this might have happened?
A lot of callers calling in. There's always on the phone. I get her back in conversation. 410-319-8888 is the number. Lolita, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, Lolita.
Very interesting conversation. I had once, you know, from time to time, I walk up to a police officer and I'll just ask them a couple of questions. But one time I asked a police officer, you know, what is it about your training that, you know, when it comes to your use of your firearm that you end up killing? And he just told me that the reality is how they're trained is that they shoot for the largest landmass, which is the trunk of your body.
Right.
So that results in a lot of death. So our police force are not trained to disable a person. In a lot of these instances where people were killed, if they were, you know, the crime does not meet the punishment of death. And had they just shot in the leg to disable a person, there would be mass fatalities. But our police force isn't trained, coupled with the fact that, you know, that we are living in a very racist society. And I wonder, when it comes to looking at the background of prospective police officers, do they ever make those links as to, you know, have they ever belonged to any kind of racist organization? I don't think they actually do that kind of background check. It's just like when you get hired at a bank, they only want to know that you don't have a bad credit, right, or you don't have a history of theft. But that doesn't stop a person working at the bank for stealing just because you have good credit.
Right, right. Lolita, thanks for the call. And I guess, you know, and I don't know the answer to that in terms of what those background checks are for local police forces, in terms of organizations.
They probably vary.
But it's not very wide. But what happens is it usually comes out after the fact. So after somebody makes some incendiary remarks, as some have had who have now been removed from the police forces in those areas. And so this is what I mean in terms of that pervasive culture, the perception of who is a criminal and how we treat criminals.
So on the way back to the phone, Zoe, is there any conversation, any kind of moves in Washington to talk about this larger question, and both in terms of the militarization of police, but also in this larger question of racial dynamic in our police forces in America, coming out of the AG's office or Congress at this moment?
Certainly. In both cases, I think the discussion people are more eager to have is regarding militarization. Claire McCaskill, the senator from Missouri, the Democratic senator from Missouri, is going to convene a hearing about that this fall to examine some of the federal programs that transfer weapons or money for weaponry to police forces. And the DOJ is also doing a comprehensive review of policing tactics across the U.S., and that was actually underway before everything happened in Ferguson, but that will include an examination of the use of deadly force and some of the racial profiling issues. And so I think there will be added resonance around that investigation, although it won't come out until next year.
Let me go to the phones again, 410-319-8888, and Rick in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Thank you, Mark. Good morning.
Good morning, Rick.
The conservative gentleman, I just want to say a couple of things to you, and don't take this personally, really. Just, if you could, allow yourself to go look up the Marine Corps, the Marine retired man in New York City who was shot in his own building complex by the New York City police. You can go to Ohio, or outside of Dayton, Ohio, John Crawford III was killed in a Walmart where he bought an air gun, a BB gun, and was shot dead in the store by police because somebody said he was a black man walking around with a threatening weapon. 2 or 3 weeks ago, right outside of Tulsa, Oklahoma, two police officers, a husband and a wife, shot dead a black male because he was walking down the street holding his daughter's hand, who had left the house 2 weeks prior to go live with him in a homeless shelter. So to say that we as black men don't feel like we're being attacked, it's a hard one for us to swallow. Thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you, Rick.
Where do we disagree?
I guess not. Well, people, because what he was saying to you is not seeing the linkage.
Well, I mean, I think, Mark, look, you and I, when we talk about individual cases, we never disagree. And when we talk about and anybody who argues that there has not been a history of outrageous racism in this country is that's absurd. We're talking about the Michael Brown case and whether all of the lessons that we learned in the past and learned in the near past can be applied to this particular case. And I don't think I don't think it's analogous to Trayvon Martin. B, I don't think that's accurate.
And I think that the difference is that's the point he was making, which is mm-hmm. we have to make this pervasive connection in America that allows these things to happen. That's the connective tissue, not whether Wilson was innocent or guilty. And any of that is not the reality. The reality is, why is this happening mm-hmm. over and over and over and over again mm-hmm. in American society? I mean, that's what I think was the spirit of what he was saying. That's where that is. Mm-hmm. And so that's – I'm sorry. Zoe, a quick final thoughts because we only have 2 minutes left. John, Zoe –
Yeah, just really quickly, you know, as a social scientist, one of the things we have to do is look at patterns and how do we connect things. And one of the things you can look at historically in America is that whenever urban unrest or riots have occurred, generally it's happened as a consequence of police brutality. We can look at the 1967 riots in Detroit. We look at Newark, New Jersey. We can look at Harlem. We can look at Watts. And we can look at, you know, South Central Los Angeles into 1992. And look at Ferguson and say, what you have are examples of police brutality toward African-American citizens. The underlying conditions have to deal with inequalities in terms of housing, employment, health care, and the like, and education. And these incidents of brutality are things that cause riots.
Zoe?
Yeah, I mean, I just want to say one thing that we didn't talk about was the activism and organizing that's come out of that.
Yes.
And that's come out of many incidences like this. You know, it's not a history of racism that we're dealing with only. It's the present of racism. And
right.
I think it's really important that we are seeing such a groundswell, especially from young activists and people who want to not only have more of a conversation about it, but actually do something and change communities. And that's pretty amazing.
And I think that is an amazing piece of this. We've covered that on this program, and we'll do more this week by connecting people around the country who are talking about this as well, because I think that is a key part of this. And a very quick thought, Rick. We have
All rhetoric is the allegory of blind men describing an elephant. You leave out certain elements and you emphasize other elements, and that's exactly what we have in the Michael Brown case.
And we'll continue this conversation on what's going on in Ferguson, how it's affecting the entire nation, and why people involved within it. We're going to go out here. Let me tell you, before I thank my guests, with a little marching band music, because this is the birthday of William Patrick Foster, who was the famous bandmaster at Florida A&M University. And when you see bands marching in America, college bands and the moves they make and the trumpets doing whatever they do and everything else, it's because he created it all. He was the author of all this for America. So we celebrate his birthday. He was born on this day in 1919. Zoe Carpenter from Nation Magazine, thank you so much as usual for being with us. Always great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. John Bullock, Professor of Political Science at Towson University, will be remaining with us for the local roundtable. Good to have you here as well.
Great to be here.
And my old friend, Dr. Rick Vatz from Towson, good to have you here as well.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Congratulations on the new printing of your book, The Only Authentic Book of Persuasion.
Thank you.
We'll be right back. Stay with us.